Welcome. This is Christopher Holmes, and this is the Zero Point Show. My interest and this show are about mystical and spiritual teachings, occult science and modern physics, as well as about what's happening in the world, the political and kind of social life of humankind upon the planet. My interest is in the zero point is a term I use for the Zero Point Institute for Mystical and Spiritual Science, and it's a result of, for me, 30-plus years of investigations of trying to understand the enigmas of human consciousness and exploring that both from a modern psychology background as well as from a mystical occult background, spiritual background. And I have a distinct perspective on the enigmas of human consciousness, and I maintain what I call the heart doctrine, that, and I maintain that this heart doctrine is taught in the different religions and esoteric teachings of the world, that a person's essential I, or self, is connected to the heart. And so I would view the heart as the place wherein somehow consciousness emerges from within the dimensions of the heart. And I contrast this teaching with the last century of modern science, which has assumed that the material brain within the head produces human consciousness. So I contrast the heart doctrine to the head doctrine. And the second aspect of my consciousness studies, which are quite unique, and the perspective which I represent is quite unique, is that I say that human beings have a zero-point center. Okay, that in a way we all have a zero point center, and that this zero point center is related to the higher dimensional physics of the human heart. That there's actually a higher dimensional physics to the human heart. And there's something essential in us, in this higher dimensional physics, in connected to the heart, that survives even the death of the physical body completely. That consciousness can persist because consciousness really originates out of this higher dimensional metaphysics of the human heart. So consciousness is not lost with the death of the material body. And I would maintain that the material body never did produce the consciousness. Instead, I would argue that there was some conscious entity that inhabited the body. The ghost in the machine, Arthur Koestler once called it. That there's some living entity that inhabits the body. As in the Bhagavad Gita, the Lord Krishna says, I am the self seated in the hearts of all living beings. So the idea is that there is a spiritual self or a divine spark or a spiritual spark, there's something connected to the higher dimensional physics of the human heart. 30 years ago, I became convinced from my studies of paranormal phenomena and parapsychology and such that indeed there is massive scientific evidence for a whole range of paranormal and psychical phenomena. From ESP to out-of-body experiences, near-death experiences, psychokinesis, ghosts, spiritual and psychical healing, that I became convinced 30 years ago that there's overwhelming evidence for such phenomena, and they've been reported throughout the world, throughout human history, such phenomena. So I asked at that point not whether or not these phenomena might exist, but rather, what possible account of the universe could allow for these phenomena to, the, what are the mechanisms of these things? How could it all work that we could actually live in afterlife planes or hell worlds or heaven worlds and such? How could that possibly work? What is a model of it? And this, through my studies of occultism for 30 years, I came to the importance of this idea that we, in a sense, all have a zero-point center. Now, I'll quote from a mystic Avanov, and he writes, "The divine spark is buried deep in every soul. We must leave the physical world of matter far behind and rise to the luminous world above to attain the divine principle of our superior soul. I engraved the symbol of the knowledge of the initiate, a circle with a point in the center. Understand me once and for all. I am speaking from experience. For me, it is not mere theory. All my life has been based on this symbol of the circle with its central point. This center, which is in us, we must find." So that, in a way, a circle with a point in its center is the best symbol for a zero point. It's like the most simple depiction of the concept of a zero point. And in Blavatsky's book, Cosmogenesis of the Secret Doctrine, she at one point describes a circle with a central point, and that central point, she says, is the first point of differentiation of a cosmos. And she's talking about the origin of the universe from a first point. That's when positive existence emerges out of negative existence. And so there's a first point. And Blavatsky suggests that any living being has such a first point. So that is like a zero point, some dynamic center by which we are rooted into the metaphysical dimensions beyond. So the idea I came to try to understand is just in trying to understand consciousness over many, many years, I found that the best symbol to understand the nature of human consciousness is this circle with a central point. And this is described by mystic Aleister Crowley. He talks in his book, The Laws for All, he talks about the mysteries of Hodit and Nui. And Hodit, he says, is the star nucleus, the point of light. Hodit is unextended. It's a point of light. So Hodit is the star nucleus, and Nui stands for space. And that's like the mother, divine mother space. And that's from Egyptian. Nui is the goddess of space. So this conjunction for Aleister Crowley of Hodit within Nui, as a point within the sphere. Crowley would compare it to the stars in the night sky. And each star is like the star is the Hodit, and the blackness of the night sky is Nui. So Crowley has as the first principle of magic that every man and every woman is a star. So Crowley suggests that we have such a spiritual spark, a point, a star nucleus within ourself, and that this exists within Nui. And it's a conjunction of Hodit and Nui that gives rise to human consciousness. And through my studies of consciousness, I came to realize to understand what consciousness is, we have to firstly understand its nature as light. This idea that consciousness is actually light. And the more enlightened you are, the more consciousness you experience. And we can be flooded and know this light at different levels within ourselves. So consciousness is connected to light. And then consciousness somehow is like space, space itself, because consciousness is like this no-thingness which allows you to be aware of all the things. But somehow this consciousness itself is like this form of no-thingness. So this symbol of a point within the circle embodies the idea of consciousness emerging from a point source of light and existing within this space or hyperspace kind of dimensions, hadit within the we. And I'm going to bring my co-host on in a moment because I wanted this to lead into a discussion. We were talking last week about the writings of the Dalai Lama about consciousness. And we were going to move on to another work this week, but I wanted to pick up on one thing I'd failed to bring up in our earlier discussions. And this has to do with how the Dalai Lama views consciousness. And what he sees as the roots of consciousness is a conjunction of what he calls empty space particles and the mind of clear light. And for the Dalai Lama, consciousness is light. An individual consciousness can merge with the mind of clear light. So consciousness, the Dalai Lama describes as light, and then he says the basis for the material worlds are the empty space particles. So the Dalai Lama has a description, you see, just like Aleister Crowley in a way, light within space. Anyway, well, now I've kind of said a little bit of what I wanted to get back to in the Dalai Lama's teachings, but I will bring Jim on. Jim, how are you?
Good. How are you, Chris?
Okay. I find it any time I could try to take this idea of zero point and approach it from so many different angles and perspectives on the concept of it. It's interesting over the years how, as you see it in different lights, it kind of deepens and deepens the concept of what is meant by the zero point teaching and such.
Yeah, well, we've talked about that several times on the program, but that's I think the whole, that's what's so interesting about the esoteric perspective on consciousness and everything that derives from it, is that you, as you move along and you learn more and more about it, it's so substantive and it's so connected with everything else that you can develop any concept and it gets deeper and deeper, and you get to higher and higher levels of understanding and applying what it means. It's like when you were talking about that symbol, about the point within the circle. I mean, somebody could look at that and say, big deal, it's a point within a circle. And you know, you look at it and you see it as representing something much, much deeper. And I think we've talked about that before, too, that throughout the ages, through esoteric teachings, there have been various formulas, verbal formulas and symbols that have been developed by people who actually knew things to try to transmit ideas in their simplest form to future generations. And the real depth of esotericism, I think, is revealed in when you begin to study those formulas and those symbols, and over time you realize how your initial impressions of them were very superficial and you really didn't grasp what was contained with them. And it's like in the Gurdjieff work, they have the symbol of the Enneagram, and Gurdjieff said that essentially that you could understand everything just by if you really knew what an Enneagram represented, you could understand the nature of all and everything. And in a way that seems like an absurd statement, but I have a sense of how that's true. Or, you know, in certain verbal formulas like that are so profound, like God is one, then first three, God is first one, then three, then seven, or as above, but so below, the microcosm of the macrocosm. And, you know, there's so many expressions like that contain such incredible depth. And that's kind of like you say, as you say, 33 years of studying this material, you come to this always deeper understanding and more connected, more it's more precise and it's more comprehensive, which I think Perhaps people would say, like, well, that's true of anything if you really study it. Well, yes and no. I think that's what's peculiar about esotericism. I think that it's that things get more precise and more comprehensive at the same time, and I think that's what's really unique about esoteric teachings. Like, even the idea that you expressed a little bit earlier about consciousness is light. Well, you and I have been discussing that for almost 35 years, and I would say that our understanding of that is a perfect example of how the knowledge. The knowledge is always expanding, and it leads to greater and greater depth of understanding.
Yeah, I remember Nichols' comments about consciousness as light, and as you grow, like, well, he compares, you might have just like a very little bit of consciousness, like one candle, or you could have an arc light of consciousness that would illuminate a huge volume of space, or... the consciousness is light, and that concept, we've kind of worked to understand that through 30 years. Like, it's not something you can just grasp with your mind and know it. It's like you have to, it's funny how knowledge deepens in you through life experiences and experiences of the light and living more in the light and being more conscious. You understand it more and more deeply. It's like some person would say, well, how come that guy Ivanov would like meditate on a symbol of a point in the circle all of his life? Like, he says, all of my life has been based on this symbol of the circle, you know? And so a ordinary person kind of like, well, like, there's nothing to it. It has no depth, you know, but Ivanov, there's like such depth to the meaning of that symbol. And these symbols and formula are really what Gurdjieff would call objective knowledge. Like, I guess he talks about myths and symbols as embodying objective knowledge, and which he says can be understood in higher states of consciousness. So it's hard for people without years of study to kind of grasp the significance of some of these ideas. And that knowledge then has to grow in us. Like, the idea of knowledge, consciousness connected to the heart, that's a whole issue you can study in yourself just by experiencing yourself in your being and where you experience yourself and how you do, where is your consciousness in your body. Like, to try to study that issue in yourself. And the more you do that, you realize, oh, that idea that consciousness is just up in my head is ridiculous. Like, that's not how one experiences himself. If you go into self-study, that's like so evident.
Yeah, and one of the things that Asimov said was that in that quote, I think, was that he went on and said, this isn't something that I just know, this is something that I live, or that's something that I experience directly, and that's a whole other aspect of it. Like, it's not just thinking about these things and intellectualizing about them, although that is very useful and important, but it's in conjunction with the study of yourself and the study of the world systematically somehow that you, through contemplation and meditation, through self-observation and the attempt to develop consciousness, that the great enigma and at the same time the great, I don't know what the word for it is, the great thrill of consciousness is that if you study it systematically, you can develop it, and that's something that it pretty much escapes all modern thinking, which is really what's lacking in modern thinking, especially modern scientific thinking about consciousness. On a related topic, two weeks ago when we were talking, I made a reference to this quote, and I completely butchered it, and I just wanted to go back to it because I think this is a really important idea, and it came from this, it's in one of Irvin Laszlo's books, Science and the Reenchantment of the Cosmos, The Rise of the Integral Vision of Reality, which is a very interesting book, and in that book, Laszlo writes, but then he has some papers by a variety of other people, and one of them is by this biologist, Elizabeth Soturis, and she's talking about how the idea of the concept of non-life and mechanism, which came from the Greeks and which basically was restored to Western thought with the rise of modern science. And she, as a biologist, she's talking about the inadequacy of this, really, to how this idea of non-life life was applied to physics and then became important in biology and the mechanistic teachings of biology. She says, was it really appropriate for science to force life to be defined within a context of non-life? Could one really explain the existence of living things as accidentally derived from non-living matter? Could one derive intelligence from non-intelligence, consciousness from non-consciousness, as I was consistently taught in the graduate science departments of several universities and research institutions? And then, oh, I just dropped my phone, sorry. And then she goes on and she says, she pondered this, that had, this is the scenario, that this is what I referred to before. She said, had Galileo looked down through a microscope into a drop of pond water teeming with gyrating life forms instead of up through a telescope into the heavens already conceived in his time as celestial mechanics, what would have happened? Might biology rather than physics have become the leading science into whose models all others must fit themselves? Might scientists then have seen life not as a rare accidental occurrence and futile struggle to build up syntropic systems against inevitably destructive tide of entropy, but as the fundamental nature of an exuberantly creative universe? So essentially what she's saying is, like, you know, instead of looking out into dead, empty space, if Galileo had looked down into this through a microscope into a drop of pond water, which is teeming with life, we might have had the idea as not as life being an inherent property of the universe rather than non-life. And she goes on, she develops that and says, you know, that this is the equivalent, I would say, in biology to consciousness in psychology, is that we really don't understand the nature of life. And to try to explain life in terms of non-life is ridiculous. It's like trying to explain consciousness as being an emergent property of non-living, dead, dumb matter. It doesn't work.
Well, I mean, I wouldn't say it's ridiculous. I would say it's a plausible theory, but then you have to have substantive evidences that it is indeed true. I mean, the problem is scientists say life comes from non-sentient matter, but they don't prove it. They have no explanation of the phenomena. That's a metaphysical assumption.
Yeah,
like,
that's why I
remember it striking me about Swami Prabhupada and his explanations of the Gita and the nature of the spirit soul. He says there's a living entity in a living being, like a human being. There's this indwelling entity, and it's the source of consciousness in your body, and its energies initiate the heartbeat and brings life into your body. So the body is inhabited by this living entity. And it is non-reducible. It doesn't derive from matter. It inhabits the matter. Like, it's embodied. So, in a way, from a mystical perspective, you might say consciousness comes from above, rather than in science, they believe that consciousness is manufactured from non-sentient matter, from below. So it's such a different orientation.
Yeah, and I mean that's why I say, in a sense, it's ridiculous, because what exactly is the evidence? I mean, there is some evidence, but that you can, you know, it's like the Miller-Urey experiment in the 50s, where if you put a bunch of if you put the right chemicals together and spark it with, you know, methane and ammonia and stuff, and spark it, you know, you can create proteins, which are the building blocks of life. So, I mean, there is, you know, I think that experiment's had a huge philosophical impact on the development of modern science and sort of the turning away from the idea that life is somehow an inherent property of the universe. But the other side, I guess, too, is that just as you say, I would say, like, life and consciousness both are stepped down from these higher levels, and that's what's sort of missing in the metaphysical assumptive framework of modern science and psychology, is this idea that everything is seen as being built from the bottom up, rather than that, that's, in Gurdjieff terms, that's an evolutionary process. But then there's, he says there's also this involutionary current, and basically all of esoteric metaphysical systems embody this idea that there are step down higher levels of consciousness and being which somehow manifest on the material physical plane what we call reality, but that there are these hidden worlds that are informing and providing life and consciousness all the time, like through the
kind of underline the physical manifestation.
Yeah.
That's like how it came, like how I see the human heart now. The heart, science thinks the heart is simply a material organ. Soft muscle tissue. So they have the material heart, but from a mystical perspective, I would say, firstly, there's like a divine source emanation, and that's the first Kabbalistic world of emanation. And then there's the spiritual worlds. In Kabbalah, that's a world of creation, and that's your spiritual self, and that you have a spiritual heart. It's in higher dimensional space in a way, but interpenetrating the physical heart connected to it and the spiritual heart. And then you have a psychical heart, which is how a person is ensouled, because they are ensouled. The spirit is brought down and ensouls the material heart. So the heart, it has a divine, spiritual, psychical, and material nature. So it's all of these things, and even when the material heart stops beating, that doesn't mean that the spiritual heart center would died. It doesn't die. It's still existent, and we'll then be clothed in different bodies. That we actually do have subtle bodies and can exist in other dimensions.
Yeah, and when you read the near-death literature, you look at what people describe happening. It's consistent with that dynamic of the withdrawal into the higher dimensions from the material plane, and something persists, and something knowing persists and is cognizant of self in these higher dimensions and describes with... very interesting consistency what people see and what they experience. There's a consistency there that would suggest that people are describing the same thing, or at least aspects of the same experiences and dynamics that are operative in those realms. So that's one thing that really strikes me about the heart doctrine, and that the model that you're putting forward is that I think that really better than anything I know is consistent with the evidence from near-death experiences.
Yeah, it's so interesting. Like the idea of the tunnel of light and connected to the heart even, and the heart connected to the spiritual, the sun, and those are really all important ideas.
And like this, the idea of the life review, I think, is very, very interesting, you know, that you have this moment where somehow life... your life as a entity in the material plane is suddenly present at astonishing speeds, and people have their life review process, and even like some of the stuff I've been reading lately is not only that people are often aware of their own experiences, but that they're aware of the effects of their actions on other people.
Yeah.
Which is very, very interesting. I mean, now that's very much in tune with like what the Dalai Lama talks about, I think, in terms of karma, that somehow there's something of a higher dimensional level or what in Gurdjieff's terms may be a higher mind, a higher mental body, or something's going on, something higher is going on in terms of the life review experience, but it's also sort of like the collapse of this incredible body of experience is somehow collapsed in time and space, or compressed, and yet somehow people know, and they know very clearly what, you know, what they've experienced, and not only what they've experienced, but what other people have experienced, you know, through their actions. A very fascinating, truly enigmatic phenomena. I think something that's so far beyond the scope of modern psychology in terms of explaining it. But in terms of your model, I think that this is very consistent with what you're saying.
Yeah. Yeah, this is striking me, like, it's the conception of the nature of the monadic element that I came to in Blavatsky's work, because she talks about how any living entity has a zero-point center, but then that differentiates into 7 zero-points. And I'd see this little monadic essence. She describes zero points as holes dug in space. Mm. So it's like, in a way, they're like little black holes. And in the modern physics on computers, and they're conceiving now of little black holes as being information processors, and that can process immense amounts of information. So I see this little monadic essence whirling away in hyperspace. It is like a seven-dimensional little black hole element. It's like the processor in the human computer. Mm. And that when consciousness withdraws into the heart, it's coming into this field of omniscience, this kind of field of all the knowledge, and so we can access that. We're going to have to leave this aside. Unfortunately, we'll come back to it another time, because I see we're just past the half hour, and I do want to move on to our next guest. We'll pick up on this next time, Jim, and talk a little bit more about the life review and paranormal phenomena like that. And I'll try to explain some of what I see as the higher dimensional physics of this. But for today, mainly I wanted to open up and talk a little bit about the idea of zero points, and that human beings have some kind of mystical center connected to the higher dimensions of the human heart. And I would maintain there's all kinds of scientific evidence that justifies such a viewpoint. Okay, so before I forget, I will mention to listeners that you can visit my website at zeropoint.ca, and I try to put samples of all my books up there. So we're going to move along a little bit. We've had my next guest is Kevin Annette, and we've had Kevin on at least two or three times previously onto the Zero Point show, but Kevin has recently taken his concerns about Aboriginal rights and the historical evidence of historic genocide against Canadian natives. He's taken this onto the world stage and recently returned to Canada from Europe. And Kevin, maybe you'd like to introduce yourself a little bit more and give us an idea of what you've been doing over the last months, if you would.
Sure, thanks very much. I was away for a month in Europe. I went to Italy, England, and then Ireland. And part of the reason was to tell people about, you know, the whole evidence of genocide in Canada and the ongoing crimes that are occurring here. But it really started off quite dramatically in Rome. I had been invited there to give some public lectures and to show our film Unrepentant. What I did on Sunday, October 11th, is I held a memorial service right in St. Peter's Square at the Vatican for the children who had all died in Catholic residential schools. And we're talking, you know, tens of thousands of children who never came back from these predominantly Catholic institutions.
Wow.
And so the Pope had just given this Sunday Mass, and he was out on his balcony talking. And right after he spoke, I stood right opposite him and did the service. And it really was kind of interesting, because it became not only just a service for the missing kids, but a kind of an exorcism. And I brought with me some of the water and the soil from right around one of the Catholic residential schools in British Columbia. And I scattered that and used that and really called out the spirits that were the spirits of the world and of death, really, that were dominating that church, calling on them to look at the blood on their hands and the crimes that they're still perpetrating against the innocent children. And it was very interesting because right after that service, during that whole time, none of the police or anyone who kind of hover around the Vatican, none of them came over to hassle me at all. I was just left free to do that. And the next morning was kind of funny. For the first time in about 40 years, a tornado hit the central part of Rome. And
wow.
It was very dramatic. I mean, it scattered all the chairs. I mean, like, to get this, 2 days after that, I get a phone call. I'm up in Genoa in northern Italy. And I get a phone call from one of the cardinals. He's a fairly senior cardinal in the Catholic Church. And he was good. He had been invited to one of my talks. He phoned to say he couldn't make it, and he was sorry, but he said he'd be willing to sit down with me at some point and talk about this letter we wrote to the Pope last year, where we asked that the Catholic Church surrender the remains of these children, help repatriate the bodies for a proper burial and that kind of thing. So something really shook loose, and I think, you know, it was definitely just being able to name that publicly right there at the spot where the crimes were planned, so to speak. And so that was quite something, and that got a lot of press, and all the television and newspaper media in Italy reported what had happened.
Wow, really? Excellent.
Yeah.
Wow. Did the Pope stay with it at all? Did he, at one point, he was up on his balcony, and you were there on the street below representing the, wow.
He was standing there with a whole bunch of cardinals, and they were like hanging out after doing whatever they do. But I think what's really significant, though, about doing it in front of that pope, like Joseph Ratzinger, was a few years ago he wrote a letter. He's criminally implicated in a lot of this stuff because he wrote a letter. Do you remember when all of the sexual abuse scandals were breaking in the U.S.?
Yes.
A few years ago in Boston and Los Angeles and that, and the Catholic Church was forced to acknowledge stuff and start compensating people? Well, he sent a letter to the bishops of America ordering them under pain of excommunication to cover up what had gone on, to silence eyewitnesses, you know, the perpetrator and the victim. And, you know, so that's a criminal act, to be telling people to cover up those actions by their own clergy. And so I think he knows that he's personally implicated in that, and they had to do some kind of gesture, which is probably why he made that pseudo-apology about the residential schools a few months ago. Which wasn't really even an apology. He just expressed sorrow that some priests had hurt some children, you know, as if the institution didn't cause it, right? Just bad apples, so to speak. But I think that, you know, that's one of the reasons I went there. And later on in the trip, I went to Ireland to meet with other survivors of Catholic abuse in orphanages and schools over in Ireland. And, you know, the pattern is exactly the same over there, including the pattern of government cover-up. Where they help the churches escape any kind of criminal prosecution or anything like that.
Yeah. Well, if you look at the history of the Catholic Church through the centuries, I mean, it's really so atrocious, like everything, inquisitions and wars and terrible things through the centuries.
Well, I know, that's the point. It's like a whole history. I mean, you know, it's the most murderous institution in human history, if you just do a body count. And yet it's posing as this kind of representative God on earth. I mean, to me, it's the biggest lie in human history. And it's part of a much bigger issue here. It isn't just about Native people. It's about, you know, like these are texts. I was telling people over here the other day, the Vatican is not only a government, right? It never has to pay any taxes. It has import and export duty-free status, okay, as an institution. So it's a big money laundering operation for not only the mafia, but, and this was exposed in several books recently, but, you know, it's one of the biggest corporations in the world with huge land holdings, that the land being stolen from indigenous people all over the world. So, you know, when you're dealing with a corporation that vast and that old, people tend to shy off from confronting it, but the point is that when you do confront it openly like that, I think they're a lot weaker than they make themselves out to be, because they've got so much to lose, and their crimes are so obvious. So,
yes, it's funny how people don't grasp it, really. I mean, it's such a shame, because there are so many good and sincere Catholics around, even though most Catholics I know have a sense of being traumatized by their Catholic upbringing.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, that's true. And you know what I say to people? I was saying that to Catholics I met in Italy. I said, look, this is not about an attack on your faith. To me, the institution is the one attacking your faith because they're betraying your own teachings.
Yeah.
And people should disaffiliate. Just write to the Vatican and say, we're not going to be part of the Vatican. We're Catholics, but we're not associated with the Vatican anymore.
Yeah.
And, you know, the more and more I think people are thinking, well, we got to take back our churches as well as take back our lives and everything from this. So I just should say to people that that event I did in Rome is actually up on YouTube and is posted on my website, which is www.hiddenfromhistory.org, and it's under updates. You can see a report of what I did in October.
Well, excellent. That's very brave of you to do that, to speak truth to power in that way, take your plight out there. That's remarkable about the tornado. It's so appropriate. It's so appropriate.
Yeah.
My goodness. Wow. It's such a shame that these people have been so betrayed by our religious institutions, like not just the Catholic Church, but what hypocrites all the churchmen have become. Like, why does no one come out and condemn these horrible wars in Afghanistan and Iraq and Iran and the threats of further wars? Like, where are the churches, you know? It's just so... And the Pope, what does he ever really say about any of these things? You know, these people are all so complicit in lying.
Well, that's because they're all tied into the state. I mean, they all have charitable tax-free status. And they wouldn't survive without that status, right? Economically, and because their numbers are falling off, all the big churches they're losing members all the time. And so, in return, they do the work of the state. They support it. They have chaplaincy programs in the military. They bless the war, basically. Even though, you know, Christ's most basic teaching was not to conduct war and to love your enemy and turn the other cheek.
Yeah.
So I mean, they conveniently ignore all that during time of war. So it's really, the thing to understand about churches is they're corporations set up by the government. There's kind of the body of believers, but then over on top of that, there's a corporate structure, which is imposed by government. And, you gotta make a distinction between the church as a religious community, which is local, and the corporate body, which is national and international. And they're the ones who are responsible for these crimes, really, when you look at it.
Yeah, even though also historically, though, so many independent separate priests and that who became like pedophiles in different remote areas, like it was like the whole church organization was rife with that.
Totally. And it's all through the system. It's like, it's because, you know, if you're a priest and you're guilty of these crimes, you know you can be protected because the Pope himself is telling people to cover up the crimes. So you know you can go into that church and be able to get away with abusing children and doing all sorts of horrendous things because it's being, you know, the green light is coming from the very top of the institution. So, and you know, the way the police and the government collude. I mean, to give you an example, in Ireland, these same kinds of horrors were going on for decades. They would take unwed mothers and put them in these things. There's a good movie called Magdalene Laundry, or the Magdalene Girls, or Magdalene Sisters, something like that, about the Magdalene Laundries in Ireland, where if you were a young girl and you got pregnant out of wedlock, they'd take away your baby, you'd never see it again, and then they'd incarcerate you in these laundries where you worked as slave labor, unpaid labor, to create profits for the church. And the survivors of these laundries were just told by the Irish government they can't receive any compensation at all. They issued this thing called the Ryan Report, which basically allowed the churches to get away without facing any criminal prosecution. They refused to name names of the abusers. I mean, it's just like what's happening in Canada with the so-called Truth and Reconciliation Commission. It's designed to protect the perpetrators. And people in Ireland are up in arms. I mean, there was like 5,000 people protesting in Dublin last year when the Ryan Report came out. And they don't take things lying down like we do tend to do in Canada. So, you know, it's good when this stuff surfaces because people can see, you know, what's really behind the mask of religion. It's just, you know, a horrible, horrible situation, you know, institution that really has to be brought to justice for these things.
Yeah, it's disheartening is disheartening. It's like when you wake up and you kind of realize the criminality of your own government, and then the kind of corruption of the whole medical system, and then they got the media, you know, complete pathological liars on the media. It's just one thing after another. All these mm-hmm. systems have become so, it's systemic problem,
sure.
And we've never been free of this in all modern human history, you know. All these wars we have, all based on deceits all the time, and
mm-hmm.
it's terrible. Waking up in an insane asylum.
Yeah, that's about it. But, you know, it's at the same time, people are waking up a lot quicker now than they used to, you know. Not just because of the Internet. I think there's kind of a quicker awakening in consciousness happening. And I, you know, when I meet people, a lot of them are aware of this stuff already. I don't have to convince people of this. It's always a question of, okay, we know about it. What are we going to do about it now, right?
Yeah.
And that's the big struggle for people.
Yeah, I mean, I think we need masses, more people to be waking up, and I agree that there's that quickening happening. I mean, we are really in quite precarious times where the kind of New World Order agenda is being furthered around the world really quite actively, with the new Copenhagen thing coming up and the pandemics and kind of and all the kind of foreign troops in other countries and all these things. It's very dynamic and kind of threatening time and ominous, you know. It's like all these sins that have been uncovered. That's what you did. It's like you uncovered all this repressed memory and history. I mean, that's what it serves to do, kind of releases that light into the world to see all of this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm actually encouraged over the last number of years, just how this is all breaking. It's kind of like watching a dam break. You know, they're running around trying to plug the leaks, but they break quicker and quicker. Especially on the stuff to do with the residential schools. I mean, it's all pouring out now, all of this stuff. And unfortunately, most Canadians don't think Native people have anything to do with them. So, you know, it has nothing to do with your typical, quote, white person. So the issue can get kind of marginalized. But it's really all about every single one of us, because the very techniques they're using now on us, they tried out on Native people years ago in the residential schools. The drug testing, you know, all of this stuff. Native people were the guinea pigs. So, I mean, if it happens to them yesterday, it's now happening to us today, and people have got to see. I mean, even on the level of Canadians pay $15 billion a year in taxes to cover for the taxes that churches don't pay, because they're free of having to pay taxes. So I often say to people, well, you know, you're carrying the bag for these institutions that murder children. Is that something you're happy with? I mean, do you want to you're helping to fund mass murder in your own country, and people getting away with crimes and buggering kids nowadays, you know, and it's like people are going to wake up and see that they do that when they pay their taxes.
Yeah, the whole system has become so corrupted. I mean, the government, I look at the billions they're putting into these poisonous inoculations they're bringing forward, billions of dollars. The 50 million doses for Canadians at one point it advertised in the Ottawa Citizen, you know, these could cause lifelong problems for the people, and it's based completely on quack science, I call it, you know, because how possibly could they have scientifically evaluated the effectiveness of these vaccines?
They've had cases of Guillain-Barré syndrome breakout already in the United States, the nervous disorder caused by the swine flu vaccine, and they predicted this would happen. I mean, people who went through this in the 70s, it's already started again. And, you know, I mean, the $300 million they paid GlaxoSmithKline here in Canada, I mean, they want to, you know, it's all about big money, really, I think. At least that's what started this. And then, of course, there's another whole agenda involving, I believe, microchipping the population, but...
Yeah. These things are really all quite terrible. I have Wayne Pronti and Dee Nicholson coming on the second half of the show, if you're able to stay over, Kevin, at all, because we were going to talk more about the inoculations at that point. But so why don't we try to just stick with the native issues? Last time you were on, Kevin, we went through some of that declaration of sovereignty among some natives. And can you give any update on any kind of further progress or with that? Or?
Well, just that it's really catching on. I keep getting responses all the time. People are working to try to establish local committees to support this Republic of Ganata movement. And, you know, so, I mean, it's kind of a gradual process of extending the web, if you like, of knowledge and action around this. Most of the support is coming in the West. There's a lot of disenchantment out West historically about a lot of stuff having to do with Canada. But more and more, I mean, we just got an email the other day from somebody in Ontario who said that they were going to start doing protests outside government offices about the need to, you know, cut ties with the monarchy, getting people to stop paying taxes, you know, that kind of thing. So, I mean, I think all of this is really, we've got to take it to a higher spiritual and political level all the time, saying, well, you know, we can't be associated with these institutions that are committing these crimes, you know. We need a new kind of arrangement.
Yeah, it's almost like a wanton lawlessness. That's how I see it. You know, it's just like, I mean, to me, the 9/11 issues are very important. And it's like the people who did that were just allowed to walk away from it.
Yep.
And the government and all our police and all the intelligence services, they all maintained that whole public deceit. You know, and they deceived their own Canadian soldiers, which they go over there, you know, all based on lies. And no one does anything. You know, the RCMP doesn't want to catch their man anymore. You know,
that was the whole myth. Anyway. I mean, I think, you know, people have got to take a step personally where they say, like, when we tell people to take an oath of allegiance to Ganata, it means we're not part of Canada anymore. We're not paying his taxes. We're not supporting the system. We're establishing a new political arrangement. And, you know, when the police come to me, I often say, I don't recognize your sovereignty. You serve a foreign monarch. You serve the Crown of England. You don't serve the people of Canada. And you prove that all the time. So the more people who do that, the more of a critical mass we can make in the other direction, you know.
Yeah. I mean, I just hope that people within those structures themselves turn around. I mean, I think that's what we need, you know, reestablish the rule of law in our countries. You know, it's so disheartening. It's like, these people are kind of destroying and poisoning every aspect of our life and environment, you know. To me, a huge issue is the chemtrail spraying. And I just watch that, and they just spray all over the sky. Like, there was the other day over in Ottawa, that I could see 30 chemtrails all over the sky. And they form all these kind of chemtrail clouds and everything, and they're spraying the people, you know. Like, we're supposed to have a military to kind of protect Canada, and we're fighting terrorism. Well, why is this form of biological terrorism being perpetrated against us? And where's the Air Force? Where's the police? You know, you can't call anyone because they all kind of run away with their tail between their legs and just tell other lies. No one deals with this. There was a native band up by Thunder Bay that had to take it all the way to the Supreme Court of Canada to try to get them to stop the chemtrail spraying. Were you aware of that case, Kevin?
No, I wasn't.
Yeah, they got it all the way to the Supreme Court because their people were becoming so sick. They had such heavy chemtrail spraying. And it gets all the way to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court said they couldn't deal with it because it wasn't their jurisdiction because the pilots were foreign pilots.
Well, that's what they do all the time. They do the same thing in land claims courts cases where the judge will let it drag out for years to basically make money for the different lawyers involved. And then they claim they don't have jurisdiction. It's designed to demoralize people as well. and have them batter their heads against a brick wall and then fall apart, and that's what happens all the time. So, you know, to me, the biggest question now is the illusions we all carry about the system. Like, we know the system for what it is. It's murderous and based on lies, and it's self-serving. So why do we keep going through it knowing it's like that? We have to create our own new arrangement. I mean, like, one of the things that Squamish elders out here on the West Coast are doing is they are talking about setting up their own traditional courts in the longhouse. And and you can do that under common law. When the law is not serving the people, you have the right to ignore the law and act, you know, establish your own justice, you know, citizens' arrests. That's where the whole notion of jury trial came about.
Yeah.
Because they didn't want to live under the authority of the king anymore and the Star Chamber courts. So people established jury-based common law courts. That's what we need to do. I mean, because that's not the legal system we have in Canada.
Jim, did you have any comments there? Are you still there?
Yeah, I'm still here. Yeah, I have to go actually in a couple of minutes, Chris.
I know we're coming up to the hour anyway, and we're going to take a break in a couple of minutes.
I was interested in the comment on the Magdalen Laundries. Several years ago, Joni Mitchell did a song on an album called Turbulent Indigo about the Magdalen Laundries. Very, very good song. Very interesting, which I had never heard of it until that and sort of thought, well, what's that? You know, it's very awful, awful story, actually. The total abuse. Kevin said they took these girls' babies away from them and then basically incarcerated them.
Yeah, horrible.
Very, very disturbing.
So one of the guys I met who went through the Magdalen Laundries, what they're doing is they're calculating the amount of money the Catholic Church made off people, right? Over the slave labor, basically, over all those decades. And they're going to present a bill at the Vatican saying, you know, we want compensation, want you to pay us this back.
Yeah.
So,
well,
nice.
Yep.
Okay, so, we're coming up. Okay, so Jim, next week we'll finish up. I wanted to go through the material, the Dalai Lama, what he says about space particles.
Right. Yeah.
Because I think I love that concept. Like, we're space particles. Like Crowley says, every man and woman is a star. Well, another way of expressing the idea is an empty space particle. Yeah. So we'll pick up on the Dalai Lama, and then that other article. Did you see the one I had mentioned about
stuff
in the blood? We'll cover that too next time. We'll have a full hour for our mystical studies on our next show.
Yeah, there's some very peculiar space particles floating around, aren't there? I'll leave it at that. Okay, thanks a lot.
Okay, thanks, Jim.
Nice to hear from you again, Kevin. That was very interesting. Thanks.
Talk to you again.
Okay, bye now.
See you guys again.
Oh, no, Kevin.
I remember all the stories my grandpa used to tell about a time in this sacred land. The buffalo did roam out on the open plain. The eagle soared high up in the sky. There wasn't any shame, there wasn't any pain. Yes, he said, they were so very proud. They lived a simple life. Mother Nature did provide. There was no law, but there was no crime. They took away our land. They put us on the run. Locked us on. changed our ways alive. Promises were made, but they were only lies. Chiefs from long ago, they will be by your side. Into the battleground, a warrior you will ride, armed with years of wisdom, many years of pride.
That's a beautiful song by Robin. It's called Sacred Land. Robin's a native friend from Western Canada and a member of the Canadian Action Party, which is also I'm involved with CAP. Okay, so getting back to our show, we've had Kevin Annette on, and Kevin's going to stay with us, and we have two additional guests coming on. And these are prominent Canadian activists and kind of truth tellers. And that is Wayne Pronte, who has a website, excellent website, www.falseflagflu.com. And then also Dee Nicholson. And Dee's involved in with the Protecting Healthcare Freedoms and Opposition to Bill C-6, which is happening in the Canadian legislature and a major issue for Canadians. So I'm going to turn it firstly over to Wayne, and Wayne can catch us up on what his work's involving, and then we'll pass to Dee, and then we can open it up to round discussion. So thanks again, Wayne, for attending, and I'll just let you take the floor. And
okay. Well, first off, thanks very much for having me, Christopher. I guess it's been what 3-4 weeks since I was on last time. And
yeah, 4 weeks. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. So you know, and there's just always so much happening. It's often difficult to know where to start and where to go with it all. But what I can inform your listeners of is that originally they had planned to roll out the vaccine, the H1N1 vaccine in Canada, sometime in November, and the government was under heavy criticism in the House of Parliament from the opposition parties, who were just screaming for them to go faster and faster and faster with this thing. And that was the only opposition that there was, or the only criticism that there was the speed at which it was going. Nobody was questioning whether or not, you know, the vaccines are going to be safe and whether or not vaccines are effective.
Diversion, a false flag for us, to focus on the wrong issue. That's
absolutely. They're framing the debate, a total false debate. About the vaccine. So, anyway, the health minister, Mrs. Aglukkaq, and ironically, someone who is native You know, this is, it's just bizarre. It just gets more bizarre all the time. Is actually, you know, in charge of this, along with David Butler Jones, who I call the chief medical obfuscator of Canada, who have been pushing this vaccine agenda up here. And so what's happened is that, under this fake pressure from the opposition parties, they did finally announce that, I think it was on October 26th, that they were going ahead and rolling out the vaccine here, that they were declaring it safe, and within no time, you know, the vaccination stations were opening up, and but this was already in place. You know, how did they go from making an announcement one day to having these vaccination stations open the next day? It's totally ludicrous. I also found one article, I believe it was called Fire Chief Magazine, where way down deep at the bottom of the article, I found a note saying there that there was they were quoting a fire chief in a small town in, you know, Ontario, saying that they already had the vaccines there. They were stockpiling them. And this was well before the release of the vaccine in Canada officially, and before it was declared, so, you know, allegedly declared safe. You know, so what I'm saying is, you know, as I've been saying all along, you know, there's an agenda in place here that they were just looking for an excuse to put through, right? And so they rolled it out, and the first people that they wanted to go and vaccinate were you know, the native peoples for one, but also the street people. And it was announced that, you know, next day practically they would be, or the following Monday they would be opening up clinics on the downtown east side of Vancouver. You know, Vancouver's Canada's lowest income area, and you know, most poverty stricken area, and that they were going to have roving nurses on the street carrying backpacks full of vaccine.
Wow.
So, yeah. So, yeah, as soon as I read that, I put a call out to a few people, and I said, listen, we have to get down there. I don't even live in Vancouver. I live quite a ways out. But I said, look, we've got to get some flyers together and get out and try and inform these people. And so we went out the Sunday before they had the nurses out. We went out, and we talked to probably about 1,000 people on the street and handed out, well, at least 1,000 brochures.
Wow, did you? My goodness.
Yeah, and we visited all of the shelters and the soup kitchens and so on where the street people tend to congregate. And we were very well received by them, I must say. You know, we stressed that we were not trying to force anything on them, that we are not with the government, we're just concerned citizens, and we just want you to have all of the facts, because you're going to be seeing these people on the street the next day, as well as in the shelters and the places where you guys go to eat. And you need to read through this and have all the facts and make an informed choice for yourself, you know. And that's basically what we're all about, what we've been about from day one, is that...
Wow. Just to comment, Wayne, what a brave and honorable thing to do that. You know, you just think that there are thousands of people you might have saved from having these poisons put into them. Especially then the quality of what inoculations they might give out to street people versus other people and so on. Just, boy, to put yourself out there like that is really honorable.
I'll just finish by saying that, you know, I just don't feel like I have a choice in this, and that's why I got in this from the beginning. You know, this agenda was going to happen no matter what. They were just looking for an excuse. And, you know, those of us who know do have a responsibility to take action, and I've been doing everything I possibly can. And, you know, if everybody would just do what they can, when they can, while they can, because they can, you know, I mean, we can really make a difference here.
Yeah.
And so I was just very, very pleased that I did manage to get a few people out on short notice that came out with me, despite the fact that it was raining and crappy weather. You know, people, you just got to take the bull by the horns and just go do what you got to do.
Yeah.
Can I just jump in here for a second?
Yeah, please, Dee, come on.
There's another concern that I would really like Kevin Annett to address, and that is... I know from watching your film Unrepentant, Kev, that the Indian Act forces natives on reserves to take whatever medication is brought to them by the government. Mm-hmm. Is there any way out for these people?
Well, not legally. I mean, Section 76 is still on the books. Section 76 in the Indian Act historically said that an Indian on reservation could not refuse mandatory medical treatment of any kind, including hospitalization and inoculation. So I legally they still have the power to enforce that, which is probably why they went to their reservations first to push the drug, because they knew they could get away with it legally. And if you want to test out something and look at the effect, and you know, then you're going to aim at the most powerless group legally. So that's mm-hmm. clearly Indians in Canada.
Yeah, that's really scary. People need to do something about that. That law has been on the books since when?
1876.
Thank you very much. We're long past that now. Have we grown up?
Well, they've sure had these inoculations as weapons of mass destruction. They've had them for a long time, haven't they? Dee, welcome. Why don't you just share a little bit of some of your current activities, and then we'll kind of open it up further.
Well, thanks, Christopher. I mean, I had to jump in there because this is such an important question for the Native people. And when we're privileged to have Kevin on with us, it's something that needs addressing. But my work, as you know and as Wayne knows and as Kevin knows, is basically focused on the constitutional aspects of what's going on. And there's a few things that are coming out right now that need to be tied together. And one of the reasons why this particular forced mandatory treatment on natives is so important is because it's about to come home to us. And the way that it can come home to us is kind of multifarious in its approach. We have Bill C-6 is in the Senate hearing committee phase. And it will go to the Senate after that, which is towards the end of the month, for third reading. And if it passes third reading, it will become law, and it violates our constitutional rights in terms of one particular clause that is even more egregious than the warrantless executions and your lack of recourse to the courts and your denial of due process, if there is such an animal as something more egregious than that. It is that there is a clause in Bill C-6 that makes us subject to the dictates of foreign authorities / governments. Now, I don't know about you, but my definition of a sovereign nation is one that can self-direct. And definition of democracy is representation by population, and what they're headed for right now through this subject to the dictates of foreign authorities is something where we don't have a vote and we don't have representation. In fact, we do not have democracy. We do not have anything resembling democracy in the slightest. And the way the legislation is being targeted right now is that through Bill 6 and other legislation, which also needs at some point to be addressed, what they're doing is dismantling our civil rights. So in as much as they have used the indigenous populations as almost like a test field or a convenient place with which to make their theories fly in the general public, that is all coming to us because Canada signed the International Health Regulations Charter, and that particular little agreement makes us subject to the dictates of the World Health Organization. So already you have our health sovereignty is totally gone because with the declaration of a pandemic level 6, at that point in time, the WHO took over the mandate to literally override anything that our government is doing that is health-oriented and dictate to us from abroad what we're going to do here in Canada. And that is, there's 193 nations that are subject to that. And yes, of course, it is a so-called democratic committee, but Canada is one out of 193. So we don't have a snowball's chance in hell of making our view legal for us. We have had our sovereignty given away. Now, on top of that, Bill C-6 has clauses in there which may be moved very easily because all legislation in Parliament is passed clause by clause, jointly and severally, which means that once a clause has been approved in another piece of legislation, it can be moved over onto any other piece of legislation at the convenience of the Order in Council or just a ministerial signature if it happens to be a switch within his own department. Okay, otherwise it goes to Order in Council. And of course the Privy Council, half of the members of that particular body are not even elected, they're heads of corporations. So you can see where the vested interests are lying on these orders in council that emanate from 24 Sussex. That's kind of interesting.
Does Bill C-6 not also say that we would be subject to not only the rules of foreign countries but also foreign corporations?
Yes. Well, this is the thing. It doesn't define the word authority, but if you start digging into the legal definitions of the wording, what you find out is that it goes everywhere from governments to corporations and several stops in between. So yeah, it kind of gives a blanket lack of sovereignty on just about anywhere they want to point us. They can listen to any expert in the world that they designate as an expert and call it an authority and make us subject to it. We've got no say whatsoever. Now, this isn't even close to what you envision under the word freedom in the dictionary, is it?
Well, I think it's so much more evident now that the idea that we've had a democracy has been an illusion, and that what people are awakening to is the fact that our government hasn't been representing the needs of the people for many, many years, and they've allowed this globalist agenda to be brought in by stealth. So
yes,
that Canadians have no idea about the WHO and how the WHO has this authority, and people just they're dummied down by the media so that...
Wait a minute, because you hit on something really important. When you said it's an illusion, democracy is an illusion, okay? Yes, it is, but so is their control. It's illusory. There is no fence there to keep the herd in. It's only there because we acknowledge it. That's
the
truth of the matter.
I'll throw in this caveat.
Sorry?
I'll just throw in this one caveat, too, and that is that of these 193, 194... signatory countries of the IHR, you have to bear in mind that a lot of those countries are third world nations who are in a third world state because of the WTO, the IMF.
Yeah,
and they are totally under the thumb of these people.
Oh,
and
sure.
And so it's not as though they are going to turn around and say no to the WHO.
Okay, well, now you're leading me down another track, which is also very interesting. Let's go on to Copenhagen, shall we?
Exactly.
Okay, because the Copenhagen Climate Treaty that's about to be signed by God knows how many nations, okay, is another one that absolutely removes sovereignty from countries. And as a side effect, it also has this neat little stuff in it that says that all these third world nations, which, as you rightly point out, have been created by the IMF and the World Bank, and, of course, we all know where the Rothschilds all fit into that, and hence our so-called conspiracy theories, ha, ha, ha. And the only thing that's theoretical here is that how to get these bastards into court, how to hold them accountable. But aside from that, there's nothing theoretical here whatsoever, not a ding-blasted thing. And what we've got in Copenhagen is we've got a treaty whereby they're literally setting up for the first time an overt governing authority at the global level. Hello, precedent. Now, you know and I know that once they've set precedent and had it up and running for 5 minutes, they'll turn around and say, oh, well, we've done it over here and it works well, let's do it again. That's how they do it. They grab a toehold, you know, and... Just as a rather shall we say, obtuse example. I was looking in my email today, and I was reading this one little joke email, and I realized how very, very relevant it is to this particular situation. So I'll share it all with you just to lighten it up. But it sure brings the point home. It goes, I became confused when I heard the word service used with these agencies. Revenue Canada service, postal service, telephone service, cable TV service, civil service, city, provincial, and public service, and customer service. This is not what I thought service meant. But today I overheard two farmers talking, and one of them said he had hired a bull to service his cows. Bam, it all came into focus. Now I understand what all those agencies are doing to us.
Too true.
Yeah. So, there it is. Essentially what we've got is we've got a net around us where the strings are being drawn tighter and tighter and tighter.
Yeah.
And the fish are being scooped up. Whatever those fish might be that depopulation by vaccination, be that the spreading of disease so that depopulation will gradually occur, and bearing in mind that once a population growth hits 1.3, statistically it's irretrievable. So in most countries of the world, they've actually accomplished the depopulation goal because the civilization will not be able to maintain itself for more than 25 years,
mm-hmm.
statistically speaking.
Actually, that's well documented in a documentary that's out there called Demographic Winter.
That's right.
The population levels are declining.
Seen it myself, okay? But the point is that, when you're sitting at a population growth of 1.8, okay, it's not sustainable. 1.3 is irretrievably unsustainable. So they've already accomplished that goal. This is basically a mop-up operation as far as they're concerned.
Well,
this
yeah,
is mop-up.
Exactly.
And
by the way, I want to also point out that as far as the international health regulations go and the WHO, this has been a very carefully methodical manipulated action that's gone back to 2003 when they first changed the definition of what a pandemic is so that it no longer included massive casualties. They changed it again following the SARS crisis in 2005, and they changed it again in early 2009 when this outbreak happened in Mexico to tweak it to make it the most easiest thing to declare anything at all a pandemic. And in fact, the pandemic that we are allegedly under now with H1N1 is absolutely nothing compared to the regular flu. In fact, the regular flu should be a pandemic. And what they've also said now is that in the last two or three weeks, the head of the WHO said that we are going to be in perpetual level 6 pandemic status for years.
Yeah, exactly. And by the numbers, when SARS hit Toronto, okay, now I had the honor of personally clearing out half of a subway car because I coughed. That's how frightened people were. They were terrified. They thought everybody was Typhoid Mary. And if you so much as sneezed in public, oh no, it couldn't be dust up your nose. It couldn't be the fact that you just got a bunch of diesel smoke belched in your face. Oh no, you had to have the flu and you were dangerous. Right? And the same thing is going on here.
They certainly create the drama and the hype and create the fear among people so that then people look for guidance as to what to do. And
yes. Take the government, turn it into Big Brother, okay, in the most benign public appearance possible, your wolf in sheep's clothing par excellence, okay, you take that, and then you add in one 13-year-old boy who drops dead. Now, what do you got? Then you have grieving parents going, get your children vaccinated, because if my son had been vaccinated, he might be alive today. What happens the next day? Thousands upon thousands upon thousands of parents panicking, because if it could fell a healthy 13-year-old boy that quick, we're going to get our kids fixed right now. Okay, and
yeah,
they stood around in the rain.
Everywhere. Just a beautiful kid, you know, very healthy-looking kid, nice-looking, lovely kid, you know, put his picture out there, made him the poster boy for H1N vaccination.
Yeah, in fact, the father even commented, which, by the way, and I wrote that article and used it, and I got some flack for using the word poster boy, but the father himself used that phrase. He said, I had no idea my son was going to become a poster boy for H1N1.
Yeah, and then did it not, Wayne, even turn up that there was question about what he really died of?
Oh,
well,
yeah,
we just broke that story.
Happened,
yeah, the day that it happened, I put out to my email list, to my associates, that, you know, I had read several articles, and the symptoms that they were looking were not at all what one would expect from somebody sick to the flu, but rather they were all similar to what one would expect if one had a case of meningitis. Okay?
Yeah, and on the other end of the country,
independently
of Wayne, was doing the same thing.
Yeah.
And what neither one of us knew at the time was that people who are healthcare workers, nurses, I mean, nurses know a lot. They know a lot, and they pay attention to the patients where the doctors don't. The doctors flip by on their rounds. The nurses live with the patients, and they know the patients, and they know the symptoms of this and that, and they know when someone's going to go and when they're not. And I talked to a nurse up my street the other day, and she said, you know, the buzz around the hospital where she works is, this isn't possible. What's going on? This isn't possible. What's going on? And that became the mantra. So a couple of days ago, we started breaking the story out of CanadiansForHealthFreedom.org, which is also, thank you very much, it's a Wayne Prante site. We broke that story online. We broke it in major media. Yesterday, after having that story for 24 hours, CBC, which had it four times, sent to their news desk under four different categories of their news, failed to mention that there was any question in anyone's mind. And on top of that, they went on to do a clip on the news about the vaccine, recommending that people get the vaccine, and again showing a clip from Evan Fristaglio's funeral. So they used him again after being told there was...
The People's Network, right? You know, I mean, it's a...
Which people would that be?
Yeah.
That's my question. Which people would that be? When they, either their reporters were so sucked in and so oblivious that they couldn't see what the average Canadian could see, that there was a question mark hanging over this one. Right? I mean, anybody. We're not doctors, you and I, Wayne.
No.
You know, but we hear enough, we read enough, we see enough, we know enough. I'm a parent, I raised two girls, you know, I've been a kid, I've been an adult, I've been sick, you know, we've all gone through this stuff, we're not ignorant.
It's a shame for doctors because, you know, doctors don't speak forth because themselves are intimidated by not going along. And then doctors are put in such awkward positions when they're asked by patients whether they would really prescribe these when they know, I believe, the majority
must realize
the danger.
Let's go right down to the nitty-gritty on that one, Christopher, shall we? It's not an awkward position. It's a conflict of interest. Let's call it what it is. It's a conflict of interest. Now, who are they supposed to be working for? I mean, don't we pay them?
Yeah, like the government,
like
the police.
Notice that all our problems are in the professions where people get paid whether they fail or not.
Yeah.
There is no motivation for a lawyer to win, okay, other than the contingency fee, which they only recently started allowing in this country, okay, but in terms of criminal actions, in terms of a lot of civil actions, in terms of corporate actions, in terms of a lot of actions, okay, lawyers get paid whether they win or not, right? And so there's no motivation for them to win. Bankers get paid, whether they win or not. Politicians get paid.
Lawyers are also officers of the court, and the courts are controlled.
Yeah.
But you see what I'm saying here? There's absolutely no obligation on any of these people to perform. And so they don't.
Yeah, they and then they wash their hands of it. That's the kind of moral position they take. I wonder, Wayne, was there a major doctor in Ontario who expressed concerns that the seeming warranted it was to give these inoculations? Was there a major news item there? Did you see that?
Yes, there was just in the past week, and there was also, I think, another one in, I believe it was New Brunswick. And there have been a few, but, you know, very few critics of this whole situation coming out. But, you know, the stories like that get outnumbered at least 10 to 1, you know, by all the propaganda. You know,
yeah.
I'm probably underestimating it, but, you know, it's very hard to find. But you will find that there have been people speaking out and criticizing all of this stuff all the way along and agreeing with what we have been saying. So there
are people out there, conscience, and
who do have some integrity out there, but it's very hard to find them. And getting back to the doctors, I mean, I'm sure we've discussed this before in previous episodes, but, you know, many of them, you know, when they're in med school and once they get into their fourth year med school, I mean, they're getting financial assistance from the big pharma and paying their tuitions and so on, and also many of them are once they open up their practice, they're also investing in big pharma stocks. So, you know, they have a conflict.
Yes, and let's while we're at it, point out that Dr. Oz, who is the poster boy of the medical community these days, off the Oprah show, now has his own show in the Oprah stable. Okay, so she's got psychiatric, and she's got medical, and she's got social. She's got the three angles covered with three shows that go boom, boom, boom in the afternoon. And who's a major pharmaceutical stockholder? None other than Dr. Mehmet Oz.
Wow.
And the company that he works for, although they deny having anything to do with vaccines, have no less than 105 references to the word vaccine on their homepage. That's what they do, is vaccine development, according to their homepage, but they deny it. Mike Adams, the health ranger at naturalnews.com, exposed that one yesterday.
Yeah, people say that they don't think the media does their job, but I think they're mistaken, because the media's job is to deceive people. Like, it is to present propaganda, to sell things commercially. And they do an expert job, and they don't provide any objective assessments in these areas. They're controlled by the corporate mafia, the pharmaceutical mafia. Just it's so disgraceful.
Oh, yeah. You know, there was a very famous quote that was issued by David Rockefeller a number of years ago at the, I think it was the New York Press Club. And he said he was basically thanking the media for being such supporters to all of their so-called medical advancements, right? Because without them, it couldn't have been done.
Yeah, and the globalist
right
agenda.
Out, you know, he comes right out and says what he means. I mean, he's not hiding anything. He's speaking to them and saying, "You're our partners in crime."
Yeah, they are. That's exactly what they are. They're partners in crime. That's how I see the major media. I'm sorry for them.
Well, you know, we've got this story broken. The Evan Frastaglio story is broken now, and we're basically saying, and this is our position. We discussed it in advance, and we took the position that, you know what? Okay, we've got some sources saying that this kid died of meningitis, and we ourselves always believe that he died of something, most likely meningitis, that was not H1N1, and that medical authorities were lying to promote fear and the dissemination of vaccines. So we said, now if we come out and say that, people are going to call us nutbars. So what we're going to do is we're going to ask the question because we need the truth on this.
Mm-hmm.
People don't seem to realize what's hanging on this. Okay, if medical authorities will lie to you to make you take a medical treatment, and on top of that, you've got a blanket diagnosis of what's going on, and this is apparently how this kid slipped through the cracks, is because they were blanket diagnosing everything that even smelled remotely like the flu as H1N1.
Yeah,
and so the question has to be raised, if Evan was diagnosed properly from the get-go, would he now be alive? We don't know. And because we don't know, do we have enough information in hand to trust the medical community? And I would say no, because until that question is answered, they don't have any basis to ask for our trust. If there's so much of a question, they would lie.
Add this one caveat to that is that we found another report in the last week which indicated that the cost of this program was now $1.5 billion, but had undergone a sudden surge to the tune of another $500 million, $500 million.
Yep.
Now, where was that sudden surge? Where did that come from? And I would go so far as to say it goes right back to the Evan Frastaglio story.
Sure it does. Sure it does. There's nothing else that's going to account for that rapid a surge in demand. Okay,
yeah.
Bearing in mind that you have to give it a little play because you're looking at a population where there were some people who are absolutely rabid for every vaccine that comes out on the market. Some people actually are like that. You know, what kind of dark hole or isolation tank they live in ordinarily, what kind of bubble they're in is beyond me. I don't see how anybody can be that dumb these days, but there such people exist. And they were going to be in the first lineups, too. So
yeah.
If you were to generously take even half of the people who stood in line and say, okay, these are the zealots, they were going to be here, Evan or no Evan. But the other half, Dan Dix from PressForTruth.ca did a little documentary clip, which is up on YouTube, and I'll have to get it posted. But the thing was, they went down to Metro Hall here in Toronto, and Metro Hall was one of the vaccine clinics that opened up for the high-risk people. So all these people are snaked out in those long lineup outside the building and everything. And why are they doing this? Well, he went down the line and he interviewed a bunch of people, and guess what they said? Well, I heard that kid died.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah,
so
the
there
impact
it is.
Or
I mean,
something like that. Wayne or Dee or Kevin, I wonder, have you been hearing of many adverse reactions in Canada? And it's interesting how when you have these major adverse reactions, the media completely will avoid that. Have there been reports coming in very much, Wayne or Dee?
Yes.
Or?
Yes, sir,
well,
I have. And there, in fact,
the very first. Sorry, Wayne, I can barely hear you anyway. Go ahead.
One of the things that we did here in the last week was, last 2 weeks, I guess, was on, if you go to CanadiansForHealthFreedom.org, right at the very top, you'll see a link, as well as in the sidebar, you'll see a link for people to report side effects or adverse reactions to the Canadian, what they're calling it, our Panrix H1N1 vaccine. And we did start getting some reports coming in, and a couple more were filed this morning. And a lot of people that we know in our own circles are keeping tabs of these things. People in their own circles are reporting to them, and they're reporting it to us, and so on and so forth. So they are coming in.
Yeah.
Well, see, one of the problems that we've got is that in the States, just to give you an idea of how bad these reporting systems are, they have what's called VAERS in the States. That's the Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System. And that system generally is known to produce about 10% of all the adverse events that there are actually make it to VAERS. And unless it's on VAERS, they don't regard it as a vaccine-associated event. Now, in Canada, we don't have VAERS. We have basically internal mechanisms. And what you're supposed to do is you're supposed to report these things to your doctor, who is then supposed to report them on. And if your doctor happens to be one of those things, who's one of those people who says, well, don't worry about it, it'll clear up, okay, the likelihood that he's going to actually make that report is slim and none. So there's two things that people need to be aware of. On that same page that Wayne just mentioned is also a list of, from the Arapanrex package insert itself, listing what are known side effects to that particular shot and in what proportion in the population. Now, you can do your own math on this, but when they say a 1 in 100 and there are 20 million people being vaccinated, that 1 in 100 now becomes a small town of people wiped out.
Yeah.
Okay, so those numbers are deceptive, and they're also very large numbers. But go there, match what you, if you have taken the shot, okay, match what you've got to what's on that list, and please report to us, because the odds of your event being recorded and sent on to proper authorities and the odds of it ever helping anybody else are going to be next to slim and none if you go through the regular channels, and that we know.
Absolutely. I want to make another point, too, and that was when we were talking about, you know, the research community and so on, and funding, who's funding all of these things. In Vancouver last weekend, on last Saturday, we had Dr. Chris Shaw speaking in Vancouver. And one of the things that he pointed out to us, which, you know, I kind of suspected, but he confirmed, was that if you want to do a research paper on showing the negative effects of any of this stuff or showing the ineffectivity of vaccines and so on, guess what? You're not going to get funded.
No.
So nobody's doing it. And so they can turn around and say, well, there's no research that supports your position. Well, why isn't there? It's because there's no funding for the opposition.
Well, actually, you know, I can point people to a link where there are over 100 peer-reviewed studies showing that vaccines are deadly. Okay, over 100 of them, all suppressed, all peer-reviewed, published studies, with as much scientific validity as any study on the face of the planet, and these studies are being suppressed on a daily basis. Furthermore, we also know that all the studies that are done are generally funded by pharma, so you've got major conflict of interest. In some cases, the pharma corporations have actually been caught writing out their own results.
Yeah.
Literally writing
right.
out their own results
and
saying, look, we'll pay you $1 million to get these results.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
The other thing that they will also do is that they will not disclose what is in their patented ingredients. And so you're only getting a portion of this product actually tested, only that stuff that's in
the public domain. Yeah, you may be getting the ingredients. You're not getting the recipe.
Right.
Do you think
the other thing that Dr. Shaw, I'll just close off that point by just saying that, yeah, I think Dr. Shaw was talking about here in Canada, you're just not going to get any funding here in Canada if you're going to go against the grain on these things, you know, but he's in a position to do it, testing what's out there in his laboratory at University of British Columbia.
Yeah. Well,
do you think that the, like the movement, the anti-vax enforced inoculations movement has had much of an impact? Like, do you think they're kind of holding back a little bit and have not gone forward much more actively because of the positive effects that the resistance has had?
I really think that we have, in large measure, I have to say, kudos have to go to Wayne here for the wonderful job that he's doing at False Flag Flu, and also to Joel Lord with the Vaccine Resistance Movement. These guys have been working hand in hand and sharing information across the country and literally around the world. And, we're getting some amazing hits. You know, we started out with next to nothing and no money. and we're getting an awful lot of attention in the hits department. And when that happens, we know that sometimes an article will be copied and forwarded to a whole list. And this is what's going on. These articles are going viral. And we know that people were already concerned, and because, you know, they are these days. I mean, generally people are a little bit more awake, and they really don't like drugs. They really don't. They'll take them if their doctor says so, but they're reluctant to do so. So we played on that reluctance and gave them information to help them make up their minds. And I think, anyway, just in my observation of what people are saying on the street and what people say when you ask them a question about it, people are a whole lot more intelligent about it now than they were even 3 months ago. And that means that we and people like us are having an impact, and that's a really good thing.
Yeah, right. Let me just also say that, yes, there's been a number of us working together here across the country. We've been able to enlist a lot of people from our own networks as well to get involved in this. And I gotta say, you know, a big kudos to the group in Toronto, to BK.
Black Krishna in Toronto.
And a whole group of people there that have been out every weekend despite what the weather's doing, on the ground handing out flyers and always coming out with new stuff and staying on top of it, as well as posting great YouTube videos and so on and so forth. We've got Sonia in Montreal just doing outstanding stuff that she's putting out every couple of days on YouTube. And she's just go, if you look for the username, The Truther Girls.
The Truther Girl?
The Truther Girls, plural.
Oh, yeah, I'll say I'll look that up.
Yeah, stuff there. And of course, in Ottawa as well, we've got a good core of people there with O'Neill and Matt and a number of others that have been very busy. So, you know, we're doing as best we can, you know, with nothing but our own individual efforts, you know, and our own initiative. And if we just have more people, you know, taking some initiative, you know, this would be a whole lot easier. But you know, one of the things I would like to point out is that, you know, the people weren't buying this to a large degree, weren't buying it to begin with. The mainstream media has lost so much credibility since 9/11 and the war in Iraq. You know, the whole war on terror issue. People know that they were lied to and continue to be lied to. We see that the National Post, or NetCNL Post, as I like to call it, is in financial trouble and could go under at any time. You know, it's because people are not buying their crap anymore and no longer subscribing to those newspapers. We've seen television stations now going off the air that belong to CanWest Global. Nobody's buying their crap anymore. You know, they're not the trusted news sources anymore that they once were. People are looking for the alternatives. You know, but we, in order to keep these alternatives out there, I'm sorry, you know, but this, you know, I'm doing all I have been doing with nothing, okay? And we could do so much more with a little bit of help, you know?
Yeah.
And so in that regard, you know, I really appreciate it if anybody's visiting False Flag Blue and using that resource on a regular basis, if they would occasionally hit the PayPal button and make a little donation. I could really use it because I've got nothing else coming in.
Yeah, and bearing in mind that what Wayne does also supports the Canadians for Health Freedom site. And so anytime you're donating at False Flag Flu, you're helping the whole network to stay alive.
Absolutely.
Guys, do you mind if I jump in for a minute?
Yeah, please.
Not at all.
I wanted to thank Wayne very much for the initiative in the Downtown East Side. A lot of people have been talking about it, and we just really, it's good when people pay attention like that and take care of the, you know, the most vulnerable. I'm feeling a bit frustrated because about 12 years ago, when I first started servicing this stuff about the drug testing that had been going on in Indian hospitals and residential schools, there was no interest whatsoever. And I think if we all tend to fall victim to the divide and conquer thing. But I mean, this kind of stuff has been happening to Native people and others for decades in Canada. And if more people had have paid attention to this sooner, we might have been able to deal with this quicker. But it's kind of like it happened to Indians, so nobody gave a shit. And I think we can learn a lesson from that, and that we can't let ourselves be divided like that. We have to take care attention to what happens to the most vulnerable, because it's going to turn out and bite us in the ass the next moment. And this is proof of that, I think. So I think that's something we need to be telling people, that these issues are all related. You know, if it can happen to one group, it'll happen to all of us.
Yeah, it's like the Native were practice session.
Yeah, very much, yeah.
You know, and it just shows you they've always had that ability to suppress populations, and they don't care how big they are, because if they're too big, they'll just minimize them.
Yeah.
You know, and they're doing it in the remote communities. I mean, there's that one community where they dug up the 1918 flu virus DNA, and that same community, which doesn't even have air access right now except for a postal and supply helicopter that comes in. Their own helicopter for people is down for repairs and has been for 4 months. How'd they get an outbreak of H1N1?
Well, same in the housing reserve on the West Coast. I mean,
exactly.
Same issue, yeah.
Exactly. I mean, these are it's a whaling community, for God's sake. These are Inuits. You know? How on earth, with no contact with the outside world, do these people come down with a virus? What, it flew across the Aleutian Islands? I don't think so.
Well, there's a couple things happening there, and like I've noticed that when was it, about 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, I had this graph posted up on falseflagflu.com, and it showed that from the time that they introduced the vaccine in the United States, within about 3 weeks, the total number of reported cases had more than doubled in the United States, okay? And so that's taking into everything that happened from about March through October, okay? And in a matter of a couple of weeks, it more than doubled. Well, I just want to draw your attention to the fact that we've had the same thing happen in Canada, because the day before, or about 2 days before, Agilicac officially released the vaccine for public consumption, I took a screenshot of the website for Health Canada and the data that they had on there, showing that up to that point they had only officially announced that 80 people had died across Canada in the 6 months or more since this outbreak. And it is now being reported that since the vaccination started in the last couple of weeks, the number of deaths in Canada officially attributed to H1N1 is now at 190.
Wow. So it over doubled within that month time period.
Two people were reported to have died right after the shot in China today.
That's
a new report.
I saw reports of miscarriages through the states.
I think one of Wayne's
mailings. I notice I'm going to take control a little bit here. I see we got about 5-6 minutes left. So there were a couple things. Firstly, I understand that on November 26th is the lawyer Sean Buckley D, who's going to be going to the Senate and giving a brief before the Senate over Bill C-6.
Yeah.
And that's on November 26th, so we're hoping...
No, it's the 25th. On
the 25th?
26th, yeah, the people who get the last kick at the cat apparently is Health Canada. Now, we're trying to do something about that because I, quite frankly, do not have confidence that Mr. Buckley is going to address particularly that clause about the foreign governments. And it's one of the... very, very nasty clauses that has received kind of short shrift. There's been a lot of constitutional challenging going on, which I'm very, very grateful for. It's the right thing to do. However, the one that is scariest to me is the one that puts us under the thumb of foreign authorities. And unfortunately, I'm not entirely confident that Sean Buckley is going to make enough mention to have a great impact on them. Therefore, we're going to either address that, because we've been invited to do briefs, we're either going to address it with briefs, written briefs to the Senate, and in the meantime, we're going to make every effort for me to get there as the representative from Canadians for Health Freedom and make that point to the Senate, because they do seem to be sensitive to the constitutional issues. The
yeah.
only thing is that they are prepared, and this makes me nervous, they are prepared to violate rights with limited scope. Unfortunately, the scope of these regulations is not clear. It never was clarified,
yeah.
and that's where the problem is. Anything could be moved anywhere. There's no
and it's
limit
the old
scope.
Story, you give an inch and they'll take a mile. Like,
yeah. In
you know,
case,
it begins incrementally.
Yeah, in this case,
yeah.
you give them an inch and they take 5,000 miles from sea to sea.
Well, I hope you do get to present, and please let me know, Dee, if you are up for that at some point, because I'm in Ottawa and would like to get out and show support for that.
I would definitely do that. The other thing is, please ask people, if you want to get representation on that issue, write to the clerk of the Senate and say, please let the delegate from Canadians for Health Freedom speak to the hearing. Support it.
Yeah, okay.
If they get letters about it, they just might let us in.
Yeah, good. Okay. I'm going to just go back. I'll let Kevin go first. Kevin, thank you again for coming and sharing
You're
with
welcome.
Us. And
good to
we'll
talk to everybody.
Keep in touch. Can
Definitely.
You just give out your website one last time?
Yeah, www.hiddenfromhistory.org.
And you
and
can
I'll be
watch
in Toronto,
Kevin's acclaimed documentary movie on his site. So thank you very much, Kevin.
I'll be in Toronto lecturing on November 30th and December 1st, just to let people know.
Oh, yeah, excellent. Good. And they can get information from your website for that?
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yep.
Great. Okay. Thanks, Kevin.
Okay.
Dee, thank you again for being on the show. I guess
oh,
we just have to all keep up our efforts. Did you have any final comments? Or?
Oh, just that we're very grateful for any opportunity to share the truth. So thank you again for having us on and for your commitment to getting the truth out there. We're going to keep kicking as hard as we can, as long as we can, because we gotta, and that's just the way it is.
Yeah, we're really in a life or death situation, and that's what people, you know, you begin to wake up, you begin to realize that and the seriousness. And we need to be opposing this on so many fronts simultaneously, the way we're being treated as citizens. And thank you, Dee, for being out there on the forefront and for your efforts.
Can't do anything else. Can't do anything else.
Yeah. And lastly, Wayne Pronte, Wayne's website is an excellent website, www.falseflagflu.com. And please, people like Wayne and Dee and myself, people in the truth movement, we do need support for our efforts. We're armed against an elites who have so unlimited funds and everything in a way is so much more difficult to spread the truth when they have such a control of the corporate media, which has become such a brainwashing propaganda machine. So, Wayne, thank you again for your efforts. Any last concluding comments, Wayne?
Yeah, I'll also mention again CanadiansForHealthFreedom.org. There's a number of great articles. Dee and I are writing a lot of original material. We're also posting stuff that other people have sent to us. But I did post up, this is really important with regard to Bill C-6. I posted up an article called Big Pharma's Revenge, The Empire Strikes Back, in the last week. And that is because they have gone ahead now, and the Health Canada and the RCMP are now trying to stop people from advertising anything that would present any kind of competition to the vaccine agenda right now. They're trying to stop people from advertising anything on the web in that regard. People need to be aware of that. They need to start taking action of that on that and start writing to the health minister, to the Public Health Association of Canada, and so on and so forth, and denouncing this crap. Okay, I've also included on that article, you're going to see statements from
I'm sorry to break in here, guys. We got to wrap her up.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay. So thank you very much, Wayne, and we'll have you back again in the future again. And I'd like to thank BBS Radio. This is Christopher Holmes. This was a Zero Point Radio Show. We'll be back in 2 weeks. I'd like to thank my guests. Goodbye.